Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast number 8 for Tuesday, July 21st. I'll be your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me today is...
Dominic Rabier.
And Ben Snitkoff.
So we have a lot of interesting stories for you this week, but before we jump into those, a couple of housekeeping notes. We have a busy schedule over the next couple of weeks, and we're not really sure when we're going to be getting the podcast out, so there might be a gap of a week or two in some of the podcast releases, but stay tuned. They'll be coming, and there'll be a lot more in August. So let's get to the stories this week. We've got three interesting stories, including the Apple and Microsoft ads, and Twitter and TechCrunch, and finally, Amazon and 1984. So jumping into the first story here, this week, Apple complained to Microsoft about some ads that they were running. Can you guys tell me a little bit more about this? What happened?
So basically, Microsoft's been running these laptop hunter ads where they show an ordinary person go around trying to buy a laptop for under $1,000. And in one of these ads, this girl called Lauren goes around and she says, all right, I'm trying to find a laptop for $1,000. I go into the Apple store and can only find one computer for under $1,000. And then she walks out and goes into, I guess, a Best Buy and then sees hundreds or tens of laptops running Microsoft Windows that are all available for under $1,000 with better specs than the MacBook. That's pretty much the essence of the ad, and we'll have a link to that in our show notes.
It's worth noting that there are a series of these ads, all of which have different people looking for different features and different price points, and all of them eventually deciding on some Windows PC. Most of them have been HPs. I think there's been one Sony that somebody's picked since these came out.
So basically what happens is that this person on the commercial will go into a retailer store, and she'll be given a certain amount of money to spend on a computer, and if she finds one that she likes, that they'll pay for it. Is that right?
Right.
And in the process of that, she makes a bunch of comments about basically the pricing of Apple computers, and that seems to be the basis of the dispute?
Yes, it does.
So what exactly could Apple do here in terms of legal options?
The first avenue that they have is that if anyone produces an ad that's taken as its whole misleading, then the people who are affected by that ad, either consumers or competitors, can sue under, I believe it's the Lanham Act. Yes?
Yes, Section 43 of the Lanham Act.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, what is it? It's DirecTV and various cable providers have been in a... several rounds of battles with suits under the Lanham Act for this kind of misleading advertising relating to who has the better picture quality, who has more HD channels or HD programming. There's actually one ad that I think Comcast aired saying essentially that Fios used a satellite, so you wouldn't get better image with Fios than you would with a satellite image, and it'd be subject to the same things. Which is true in that Fios does, in some point, get its image beamed down from a satellite and then it's sent by fiber optics to your house. But, you know, the same is true with cable TV. But the way the ad was written, it made it sound like you need a satellite dish on your front lawn to get Fios. These are not uncommon suits to bring.
So basically you have a competitor of another company who is using the other company's trademark in their ads, so they're using it almost as a comparison, basically. Is that generally okay to do?
Generally, comparisons are perfectly fine and even encouraged as long as they're honest and not misleading. So a comparison, I mean, you can say that you can buy our product, which is $10 cheaper than the competitor's product. That's fine as long as your product is actually $10 cheaper than the competitor's product. If it turns out the competitor's product is actually $10 cheaper than your product and you're just lying in the ad, that's not fair competition.
So I guess what happened was Apple has reduced the prices on some of their notebooks, and so they're a little upset because they think that the ads as they're running today don't necessarily reflect that price change. Is that right, Ben?
Yeah, that's my understanding. So it's worth noting that this story comes from a Microsoft executive who said that... So this is all, you know, secondhand through this Microsoft executive. He said that an Apple lawyer called and said, you know, we really think that you should take down these ads because we'd lowered our prices. The way some people have interpreted that is that Apple was saying that these ads are unfair because, you know, Apple lowered their prices a few hundred dollars, depending on what model laptop you're getting. And as a result, you know, these ads are, you know, substantively unfair. Another way that some people are looking at this is saying that, you know, the price that they're representing certain Apple computers as having is incorrect in some of these ads. I would lean toward the latter one, which makes Apple look less absurd, but I'm also a huge Apple fanboy, so I'm not really impartial here.
Dominic, do you have any thoughts?
Ben pretty much summarized it pretty accurately.
So Section 43 is actually pretty expansive in terms of what it covers. It can encompass a lot of different types of false advertising and various types of commercial activities using a competitor's trademark, and these types of comparison ads and other ads also, which just mention competitors. So interestingly, after this, the first ad that had aired, which is the one I believe with Lauren, it sort of surfaced on the net that she was actually an actor of some sort, and she wasn't just some regular person that was picked up on the street and asked to do this. Do you think that has any impact on this at all?
Go ahead, Ben.
It very well may. So the way I understand that panned out is that Lauren is a member of the Screen Actors Guild or some order. She's a union actor. But the argument was that in the capacity in which she was found for this, she was not acting. There is another problem in that it seems like a lot of the shots in these are staged. We'll post in the show notes a link to an article with this ad in it. But in this ad and in other Microsoft ads, you can see, you know, in this ad, for example, Lauren walks into an Apple store and you can see somebody walking into the right side of the frame, and then the camera cuts and she's walking out of the Apple store, and that same person who's walking through the frame is still walking through the frame. So she was in the Apple store for, you know, no more than a couple of seconds, just long enough to get the shot, and you can still see this person, you know, walking through. It seems like they're staged, and that would go to whether or not, as taken as a whole, these ads are misleading.
Dominic, any other thoughts?
Ben again pretty much covered it. The whole sort of point is whether or not the ads are misleading. But in terms of generally whether actors themselves, obviously actors are fine in ads as long as you don't pretend that they're ordinary people when they're not. Here, I mean, they don't actually say she's an ordinary person in the ad. They just kind of make it seem like she might be, but they never actually claim that she's an ordinary person who they've just followed around. They just make it seem that way. So I think they're probably all right, just because it's advertising, and you get a lot of leeway in advertising because of the fact that it is advertising.
Right, and there's also a difference between an actor acting as an actor or actress and an actor acting as a normal person. If you see this all the time in commercials for law firms, there'll be somebody standing on screen and says dramatization or actor is not a lawyer. That if Lauren really was a person they found on Craigslist and said, you know, don't act, we just want you to, you know, look for a computer, narrate what you're doing, it's not nearly as misleading as if they gave her a script and said act like you're not reading off of a script.
So in the end of the day, what do you guys think in terms of what's going to happen with this? I mean, does Apple even have a viable claim here, or is it too close to call?
I don't think that they're actually going to go through with a full-scale lawsuit. I think it's more sort of blustering and just trying to, I'm not sure exactly what sort of press they're trying to spin here, but it fits in. I mean, Apple doesn't, I would imagine from a business strategy perspective, they don't particularly want Microsoft hitting back on their cool or image. And the price point is the Apple's one weakness, if you will, or strength, depending on who you ask. It's probably a sensitive area, and they, I guess, wanted to scare Microsoft off. Or I'm not entirely sure why they even complained about it in some sense.
Right.
But I don't think it's going to go into a full-scale lawsuit or anything like that.
I agree that it probably won't go into a full-scale lawsuit. The one thing that I would like to see happen if, and I haven't gone through all of the ads to look for this, if they're pointing out a specific Apple laptop and misrepresenting the price of it because the price has changed since they recorded the ad, I kind of would like to see them change that or cease running that ad, because then you are, you know, making an affirmative misrepresentation as to, you know, a material aspect of your competitor's product. But other than that, I don't think the ads as a whole are misleading.
So let's just assume for a second that there is some sort of viable claim here. What sort of remedies could Apple get at the end of the day under the Lanham Act?
Anyone? Burn, David. That's a tough one. So one thing that they could do is they could get the ad taken off the air. They could also get whatever damages they have incurred from that. But damages in trademark cases are notoriously trademark and Lanham Act cases are notoriously hard to calculate. It's hard to, you know, figure out how much your brand was damaged or how much business you lost from use of the trademark.
To sort of take a big picture answer and piggyback of what Ben was saying, there's sort of three types of compensation that they could get. They could get what's called equitable relief, which includes injunctions such as taking the ad off the air. That's basically meaning something in equity, in other words, in the idea of fairness, that we're going to compensate you for the damage you took, or in other ways. They could also get damages for any misuse of their trademark or any profits that Microsoft can be proved to have derived from these ads. And finally, they can recover, in some cases, attorney's fees and costs, depending on how egregious the ads were. That's sort of the big picture Lanham Act remedies.
So, good points, guys. One thing I might add, though, if it's determined that Microsoft went forward with these ads willfully, especially after the point of notice when the Apple attorneys contacted the Microsoft executives, I think willful acts under Section 43 of the Lanham Act, in some circumstances, you can get treble monetary damages for the ads in that case, if it were so found.
Treble just being a fancy lawyer way of saying triple whatever the nominal damages, regular compensatory damages would be.
Well, I think we've covered this one pretty good, and it seems like it's a pretty thin argument for Apple. We'll have to see what happens. I think up to this point, though, the Microsoft executives have said that they're going to continue running the ads despite Apple's contentions over it, and I don't know, maybe we'll see if a suit gets filed or something like that. So our next story has been dubbed Twittergate by some. It basically involves Twitter and the microblogging service and TechCrunch, which is a technology news site run by Michael Arrington, who's actually a former attorney himself. Basically, what had happened, apparently, was that sometime in the past, and I've gotten sort of conflicting reports on exactly when this happened, it might have been more recently or it might have gone back as far as April, Twitter was compromised, or at least portions of Twitter were compromised, and portions of personal email accounts, more specifically web email accounts like Gmail, were compromised by a French hacker. And he got into the email systems, and some of it was, again, personal, and some of it seemed to be internal to Twitter, and he was able to access a lot of personally sensitive information about employees, including PayPal account information, Amazon account information. He also came across a lot of sensitive business documents, including meeting reports, personal email accounts of meetings that had happened, and a contact list that Twitter has with notable web celebrities and sort of TV personalities that hold accounts on Twitter. In total, 310 documents, apparently, were sent to TechCrunch. And TechCrunch is sort of a little bit notorious, I guess you could say, although a lot of technology news sites do this. TechCrunch is a little notorious for its very expansive coverage of Twitter. Like, almost every day you can usually find a post or two on TechCrunch about Twitter. And Mike Arrington came out, or maybe it wasn't Mike Arrington, but the TechCrunch crew came out and said that they were considering posting and making available some of these documents that they had received from the hacker online because of the newsworthiness of it. And as he said that, and as he made it known that he'd received these documents, a lot of the other journalist sites and other technology news sites had come out and sort of said, well, this is, you know, ethically questionable, and people started to question whether or not Twitter could sue TechCrunch in the end of the day for releasing this type of information. And finally, I think it was on July 17th, TechCrunch did, in fact, make some documents available. It was not all 310 documents, and Mike Arrington came out and said that he was limiting it so that there was no sensitive information, no personally sensitive information that would be posted. But he did include things like financial projections, meeting minutes and meeting summaries, defensive strategies that Twitter is using, prospective M&A stuff, or any types of acquisitions that Twitter was considering. And I think the question is still a little bit out there. It doesn't look like he actually got authority from Twitter, although he claimed to do so in the post. Evan Williams, who's one of the founders of Twitter, along with Biz Stone, Evan Williams came out and actually on Twitter, he made a post that said that it was sort of disclaiming any type of green light that was given to TechCrunch to post this stuff. So what do you guys make of this, and what sorts of stuff, what sorts of legal claims could Twitter, in the end of the day, if they so choose to go forward with a lawsuit, make against TechCrunch?
Well, they could probably sue them for some sort of trade secret spreading trade secrets, in that there's probably stuff in there that has been kept secret deliberately, and TechCrunch might be revealing some of it, knowing that it's a trade secret.
So could you explain a little bit more about what trade secrets are and what's required for...
So trade secrets trade secrets are a form of intellectual property. You usually don't hear as much about them compared to something like copyright or trademark or patent, which are the other forms of intellectual property. But trade secrets are basically a way of protecting IP by keeping it a secret within the trade. And some of the requirements of trade secrets are that you have to keep them secret. In order for them to be keep trade secrets. One of our commentators in our chat box is mentioning that trade secrets are, you don't hear much about them because they're secrets. In any case, what you can do when you have a trade secret breach is generally you need to show that you did your due diligence in trying to keep it a secret. It's not, you can't say, publish something and then say, oh no, that's a secret. You can't know that because you just kind of made it a non-secret by publishing it. Applying to the facts of this case, Twitter's documents on its own servers and its own confidential accounts, from what I understand, the way the hacker gained access was going through a Google Apps account after compromised employees' information. He was able to then go through and get documents via that. And so basically, Twitter just needs to assert there are secrets in these documents. We have tried to keep them secret. TechCrunch is now revealing them, knowing them that they're secret. We provide them notice, don't publish this, this is a secret. And then it goes from there to see whether or not these whatever's published in these documents is actually a secret and whether it was actually published by TechCrunch.
There also has to be some sort of inappropriate act in obtaining them. It doesn't necessarily have to be illegal, but it has to be... I wish there were a better way for me to articulate that.
Some way of compromising the secret, basically, without...
Right, without necessarily committing some illegal act, but there's you do have to do something inappropriate in order to obtain the secret to qualify for having breached the trade secret.
Are there any other privacy torts that might apply to Twitter as a company?
There are a lot of privacy torts that could apply. So the four basic invasion of privacy torts. You've got I should remember these off the top of my head. You've got false light. You've got anybody can help me out here with these. False light, misappropriation.
Right, misappropriation of likeness. Public dissemination of private facts, which I think is probably one of the bigger ones.
Yeah, probably the most. And what's the last one? False light, public.
Invasion on privacy and seclusion.
Intrusion on seclusion.
It's a general claim of invasion of privacy.
Yeah. Okay, so assuming all of these are true, we're not going to have a false light. So a false light claim is, it's anything that falls just short of defamation. It's publishing something about a person, or in this case it would be a business, that isn't true, but at the same time it doesn't hurt their reputation. It doesn't rise to the level of defamatory. Misappropriation of likeness isn't something that's going to be an issue here. That would be if I made some sort of Wheaties knockoff and put Brett Favre on the cover of my Wheaties without him agreeing to that or him getting compensated for that. And as Dave pointed out, you know, the two that we're going to have most likely be at issue here are public disclosure of private facts and possibly intrusion on seclusion. But when you think of intrusion on seclusion, you think of, you know, somebody leaning over your fence to take a picture of you by your swimming pool. Not so much what happened here.
basically in areas where you have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Right.
I think it's the legal standard. Mm-hmm. So would these actually apply to Twitter, though, as a corporation?
Corporations are persons just like everyone else. They're just not human persons, but they are persons in the law. And they do have rights of privacy, as far as I know. These rights don't extend perhaps as far as a private individual might, but as public corporations, they certainly do have rights of privacy. And further, the people who author the documents have rights of privacy pertaining to the contents of those documents.
Now, does the fact that a third party, essentially this hacker who had illegally obtained the documents and transferred them over to TechCrunch, does that have any bearing on the case at all?
No, it doesn't. At least not in my view. Dominic, you were going to say something?
I was only going to say the only bearing it has is that if there is a trade secret, something then if there is something to do with trade secrets, then it's a clear sort of breach of the secret in a non-authorized way. In other words, it would substantiate that the secret was disseminated without wanting to be told to everyone.
Yeah.
It's clear that they didn't want the hacker to come and get it.
Generally, if you somehow come into these private facts, regardless of who told them to you, if you disclose them, you're still going to be liable for this. You can't claim, disclosing these private facts wasn't illegal because that guy told them to me. You're still, disseminating these to the public.
So why then did TechCrunch go ahead and publish these things anyways?
The argument, as far as I understand it, that Michael Arrington advances is he sees that his site basically talks about stuff that's leaked from employees or tries to stay on top of the rumor mill of the tech industry. And though a lot of their news normally comes from just whispers that people will send them emails confidentially or leaks or something like that, and he doesn't see this as that different. In terms of, it just happens to deal with Twitter. It's a much larger leak than what you would normally see. And it is news. It's worth noting that he says that they don't want to, that TechCrunch is not going to publish any, quote, sensitive information, like passwords or anything personally embarrassing. But he does say that some of the documents in this collection of 310 documents are so interesting and so newsworthy that they should be published.
It's worth noting that just like in defamation, with most of these privacy torts, there is, a balancing that goes on between how newsworthy this is and, what the status of the people you're talking about is, and that's compared with the invasion of the privacy. So, corporations generally are to some degree public figures, and if these are matters of public importance to some degree, that will be weighed against the invasion. And Michael Arrington's First Amendment right as a publisher to publish these things as a news source to put these out there will be weighed against Twitter, the invasion of privacy that Twitter has felt because of the publication of these documents.
So if we assume that Twitter would qualify as a public figure under the sort of the guise of the New York Times case on defamation, I think it was New York Times v. Sullivan, which in that case requires that in certain instances of, at least in defamation, I think it partially applies, and you guys can clarify for me, for some of the invasion of privacy torts, that you need to have actual malice proven, and actual malice is generally knowledge of the privacy of facts or the incorrectness of facts or at least reckless disregard. Would those apply at all to this? Ben?
I didn't quite follow that question. Could you repeat that?
Well, so New York Times v. Sullivan requires actual malice be shown on a part of the person who is disseminating certain types of communications. And at least they definitely apply in defamation cases with public figures. And, for defamation, those usually involve a question of whether or not the statements are in fact false or true. And the truth is usually an absolute defense to a claim against defamation, but if you publish something that's false against a public figure, malice needs to be shown, so you need to show that the person who published it had knowledge that the facts that they were claiming to be true were in fact false, or that they showed some sort of reckless disregard for the truth of the, the facts themselves, meaning that they didn't take the time to go back and verify that the facts were actually correct. Right. Do those apply, though, at all to these types of privacy torts?
You can't apply those directly, especially in the case of a public disclosure of a private fact. The nature of that is that the facts are true, so you can't go back and decide whether or not it isn't quite as clear of a standard to apply is what I'm trying to get at. It's much more of a balancing test. You look at how public the figure was, whether or not the figure, or in this case, the corporation, voluntarily put themselves out in the public, whether they whether they were out in the public for this specific reason, whether the press brought them out in the public. I wish there were a really clear standard that I could say gets applied in these cases, but it's very much a case-by-case analysis, weighing the interest in disclosing the newsworthiness of this balanced against the right of privacy that the individual or the corporation has.
So does the First Amendment come in here at some point and sort of limit any type of liability that TechCrunch might have?
Dominic?
It might potentially, but
We are talking about newsworthy things that are going on. Clearly people are super interested about what's going on behind Twitter because they've been very quiet about potential business models and stuff that they might use to monetize Twitter. And clearly some of these documents indicate that they do have a lot of direction. It's very detailed, and people do want to know, but it's still a private company.
Correct. I mean, you said it better than I could myself.
Yeah, I wish we could be, more solid as to, which way this is going to go or if Twitter is even going to bring suit, but it's a very difficult determination to make. Yes, people want to know about this kind of stuff, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a First Amendment right to the disclosure of, private facts internal to a corporation about, its workings. Especially when that corporation isn't a public corporation. Twitter has not had an IPO, right?
I mean, the First Amendment applies to the U.S. government. It does not apply to personal. It does not apply to corporations or people in general. You can't come post, for example, on the technically legal website, and then if we don't like your comment or we remove the comment because it's spam, you can't say, "Oh, you're violating our First Amendment right," because there is no First Amendment right because it's a private entity. So in that sense, there isn't really any sort of First Amendment claim that I can think of that TechCrunch could really bring, unless there was something terrifically newsworthy that they would be able to reveal, that would somehow be somehow relevant to the public in general.
I'm going to disagree with you there. The basis of this balancing test between the newsworthiness and the privacy comes from the First Amendment. And it's the same reason that when you've got, a company, a really violent video game, and some Florida lawyer decides to sue the makers of this video game because the video game allegedly caused some person who played the video game to go out and commit some sort of crime. The basis of why you can't go after that company is that First Amendment right, and it's, this... The government will not enforce a judgment against somebody that violates the First Amendment, because the mere element of the government enforcing that judgment invokes the First Amendment right.
Right, but we're agreeing about different things, I guess, in terms of you're seeing the First Amendment, the TechCrunch's First Amendment right to publish this. Is that right?
I mean, yes.
Okay, and I was speaking more about the fact that the First Amendment right that Twitter has over commentary on it of its documents. In some sense, this is something Twitter published. This is Twitter's, and TechCrunch has obtained it somehow. TechCrunch doesn't have a right to obtain Twitter's documents without Twitter's consent because of the First Amendment. That's basically all I was saying.
Okay,
so I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on here. Before we move on, we could step back a little bit from the legal aspects of this and just talk about ethics for a second here. You've got Mike Arrington, who's a real smart guy. I believe he was Stanford Law educated, former lawyer, is probably at least has some awareness of all of these legal concepts that are behind this, and he gets these documents and still goes ahead and publishes some of them. What do you think about the ethics that are going on here? I mean, is that ethically sound for a journalist to do? I'll put it to you in a different way. If you were in Michael Arrington's position, in his shoes, when he received all of these documents, would you have done the same thing?
It would have to be the most important document about Twitter ever released for me to publish that. It doesn't rise to the level of public importance that I think you should worry about, that would justify this kind of thing. When I think of stuff that needs to be published, despite the fact that it was gotten by illegitimate means, I'm thinking, like, Pentagon Papers. Like, really important to the public good, like, these are the things the public deserves to know, and I can't imagine that there is anything in those papers that is that worthy.
Dominic, any thoughts?
Considering the means by which these documents were obtained, I wouldn't feel comfortable publishing them if I was the editor of TechCrunch.
I think I'm going to agree with you there, Dominic. And before we move on, it's sort of interesting to note that perhaps a lot of the damage has already been done here in this case. I know that doesn't really matter under the eyes of the law, but it certainly, factors into perhaps what Twitter is thinking about doing, because the documents have then been published, the information has gotten out there, so there isn't very much that they can do in terms of trying to enjoin TechCrunch from publishing the documents in the first place, since they're already out there. They might be able to get an injunction from further publication, maybe get them to take it down, but I think most of the people who are interested in reading this stuff have probably already read it, and it's probably an important lesson for Twitter in terms of security policies and making sure that their employees abide by some sort of security policy that is pretty tight, and hopefully there'll be some changes then in the future. So, moving on to our last story then, 1984, and I don't mean the year, I mean the book. And that is Orwell's famous 1984. Apparently this week, what happened is that a bunch of people had downloaded a copy of 1984 onto their Kindles, and Amazon came out and took it back. And people got up the next day and realized that their copy of 1984 was no longer there. Ben, you covered this on the website. It got some interesting comments, too. Can you tell us a little bit more about what happened?
Right. So essentially what happened is a publisher submitted a copy of 1984 formatted for the Kindle. This is a company that traditionally republishes work in the public domain, and most of the other stuff that they have for the Kindle store is work in the public domain. The slight problem with that being that 1984 and Animal Farm, the two books in question, are not in the public domain in America. So they essentially put unauthorized copies of this, submitted them to Amazon. Amazon put them up on the store. People purchased them, and the estate of George Orwell said, excuse us, we did not give you permission to sell these works, to make copies of these works, and to distribute this copyrighted work, this work that's still under copyright in the United States. So Amazon made the split decision to take it off of the Kindle, caused quite a stir on the internet, and actually breached Microsoft's end-user license agreement with the people who own Kindles.
So what did the license agreement say then that's relevant here?
The license agreement says that once you pay for the book, you will get a permanent right to use and view the book on your device.
So basically it authorizes some sort of permanent copy, but just for use on the Kindle
right.
At the end of the day. Did any of the people who lost their copy of 1984, did they get anything in return? For losing it?
Everyone got refunds for their purchase price.
So whatever they paid to have 1984 on there, they got their money back in the
precisely,
United,
yep.
But they lost their copy.
Correct. It was deleted off their Kindle. I mean, I personally find this case incredibly with poetic irony in the sense that it's 1984 and it's being remotely deleted from people's Kindles. It also isn't particularly the best in terms of publicity for Amazon if they're saying that the Kindle is just like a book, only better. Well, no one really... I mean, if you buy a book, it's generally not going to disappear because the publisher doesn't want you to have it anymore.
Well, I mean, in this case, to be fair, it wasn't that the publisher did not want people to have it anymore. It's that somebody had violated the publisher's rights in the book. And the publisher said, well, that's kind of unfair. It's not like the publisher... It's not like the people who legitimately own the rights to the book put it up and changed their minds and took it down. Somebody had put this up without their permission, and then the publisher said, take it down. But I do agree, it was a... unfortunate choice of book for this to happen with.
Very Orwellian for them to come in and sort of take it back, as Amazon, aka Big Brother, has sort of stepped in and removed some rights from people.
I guess this sort of does lead to a kind of interesting discussion, perhaps, on the implications of ebooks versus books. I mean, and just technology in general, and how the law needs to perhaps change or needs to adapt to deal with something in that. Before, if you bought a book, well, you had a physical object and it wasn't going to go away. If your license agreement changed, or if someone had once misinterpreted something and then published something that they shouldn't. Where here, there's sort of an undo feature in some sense. The publisher, as Ben says, found out that they couldn't actually publish the book, and Amazon revoked it and refunded everyone their money, but their book disappeared. What sort of implications do you guys think that this has for ebooks in general? And should people, once you buy something, should you be able to keep it? I mean,
well, you know, I think this raises a lot of awareness. So first of all, you know, this is a license agreement. It's even though that the license agreement says you are authorized to have a permanent copy on your Kindle, you're not actually getting a copy in the same tangible sense as you might get a book. So the first sale doctrine, when you go out to a store and you buy a book, the first sale doctrine permits you to, first sale doctrine under the Copyright Act permits you to do whatever you like with that book. You can go and sell it to other people, and you don't have to pay any royalties back to the original copyright holder. Doing that with ebooks is so different because you're just getting a license to use it on your device, and that's it. And I don't use a Kindle, although I think Ben owns one. And they are really neat devices, and someday maybe I'll actually pick one up. But you don't get those same rights because you're limited by the license of just being able to use the ebook for that one limited purpose, using it on your Kindle device.
But do you think most consumers have that distinction in their head when they buy a book on the Kindle? Do they see that as different from buying a book?
It's hard to say. My guess is that probably to some extent, yes. You're talking about sort of characterizing what's on everyone's minds as they go out and buy a Kindle and buy content for their Kindle. But my guess is that they probably have some awareness that they're not going to be able to do the same types of things with their e-copy that they might be able to do with a real book, you know, a paper-bound book.
Right. I can say that one of the most noticeable things that happened after I got my Kindle was I read a book and I was like, man, this is a great book. I really should let my friend borrow it, but I can't. From growing up and reading books and passing books around back and forth to friends, it was essentially a jarring experience. It's a hugely different, I hate using this word, but like paradigm in consuming books. You know, you read the book, you finish it, and it's still there, and you can search it, which is great, and you can annotate it, which is great, without actually, you know, writing on the pages, but I can't let anyone else read the book without giving them the Kindle. It's very strange. We also saw a similar issue with this come up when the Kindle 2 came out, and Amazon had enabled text-to-speech, but the Writers Guild of America, not the Writers Guild, the Authors Guild, came out and said, you know, we think this violates our right to make audio reproductions of our books, and Amazon introduced the ability for people to not allow Kindle's text-to-speech to read out books.
It was a robotic voice anyways, is that right?
Yes, it was. Yeah. It wasn't a bad robotic voice, but it was a robotic voice. It wasn't the quality of, you know, an Audible.com download. I shouldn't have said .com. I feel like I'm sponsoring them now. We are not sponsored by Audible.com.
At least not yet.
I don't know. I might like it if I get read some physics books in the voice of Stephen Hawking. So, just based on a general robotic voice.
I thought it was pretty cool that you could read a book and then say you're going to drive in a car and you have it keep reading to you while you're driving and you can pick off right where you left off. I thought that was pretty cool as someone who reads a lot of books and has found that reading while driving is not very safe at all. So,
I've heard varying things as to the quality of the voice, but that's, I think it would be annoying to listen to it for that long, but that's really for another day.
Yeah, that's a personal thing in the end. But getting back to the legal stuff now, so based on the express language of the license agreement, it does sort of appear that Amazon never really reserved the right to go back and remove things that people have purchased. Even though that they, in the end of the day, they went back and rebated all the people their money for what they paid.
Right. They expressly, in fact, did not reserve that right. I'm going to read directly from this. Amazon grants you, quote, Amazon grants you the non-exclusive right to keep a permanent copy of the applicable digital content and to view, use, and display such content an unlimited number of times. So clearly these people can no longer view that content an unlimited number of times as it has been removed from their Kindle.
But the last sentence of that paragraph does say digital content will be deemed licensed to you by Amazon under this agreement unless otherwise expressly provided by Amazon. I don't know whether Amazon expressly provided prior to deleting. Did they say anything to people or did they wake up and they find their books were gone?
They woke up and found it was gone.
You know what's interesting is a lot of times in terms of service agreements, you usually have a section on warranties in terms of what the licensor, in this case, Amazon, is in fact licensed to give out. And the underlying issue is that they were never authorized by Orwell's estate to use this on Kindle. And basically, if they never had any authority to do that, if they had such a provision in their license that said, you know, we're warranting that we do have the authorization to give these things out to you, it would seem like that subject matter might actually fall outside of the license agreement itself, but that's just not here. So do you guys think that there are any remedies that some of the Kindle owners might have against Amazon in terms of breach of contract?
So yes, they can sue for breach of contract, and I want to amend something that I had posted. I put a comma in a disclaimer here that was not actually there. So you can sue Amazon for breach of contract, but you wouldn't be entitled to incidental damages or consequential damages, which are two very special measures of damage. Well, consequential damages are kind of a special measure of damages, incidental or not. Do you think it's worth going into these guys or?
Why don't you just explain to people what consequential damages mean, and in fact, even back up and explain what sorts of damages, absent any of the disclaimers that are in this license agreement, are available under just a general breach of contract theory.
Okay, so the general damages you can get for breach of contract would be either whatever it would cost to complete the contract or whatever it would cost to put you back in as good a position as you were before this whole mess ever happened. Now, as for what incidental damages are, the costs that are associated with, let's say I hire Dominic to paint my house. Dominic says, fine, he'll paint my house for $300. He then calls me up a couple of days later and says, you know what, I'm not going to paint your house. I pick up the phone, I spend a few hours calling people, I finally find a new person to paint my house. He says he's going to do it for $400. So what I can do is I can sue Dominic for not just the $100 difference between what he promised he would paint my house for and what I actually have to pay. I can also sue him for that time that I spent, the phone calls that I made, trying to find a new person to paint my house. Those phone calls, that time I spent, is incidental damages, and that's always recoverable in a contract claim. What isn't always recoverable is consequential damages. Consequential damages are very special. So the seminal case of consequential damages is this guy had a mill, and a shaft in his mill broke. And he went to a shipping company. He said, guys, you got to do this quick because my mill's not going to work while you guys are doing this. And they said, no problem. We'll have it back to you in 5 days. Something went wrong. It took much longer than 5 days. And the guy sued. And not only did he get, you know, his money back from what he wanted was both his money back from, you know, the extra time that it took to get it back and the lost profits from his mill, because he claimed that he told the mill that it was going to take extra time. The court, which was an English court, disagreed. They said that, you know, well, yeah, I don't think that they actually knew enough about, you know, that your mill was going to be shut down, what kind of profits they were going to lose, so you're not going to get that consequential damages. The damages that were foreseeable that you told the person about, that they knew were going to happen if they screwed up, but they still screwed up. So those are consequential damages.
That was a good summary of damages in general, I think. So based on the disclaimers they have here, and based on what Amazon has already done, being that they've already rebated the price of the book back to the people when they bought 1984, what can they claim in a breach of contract action then?
In this case, very little. And I think the bigger issue is that they don't want to claim anymore. I don't think you would want to sue Amazon saying that you breached my contract and that, you know, you should do something else here. Because Amazon, since the contract's already been breached, if they get super breached, Amazon can just say, okay, fine, we'll shut off your Kindle, you know. No more access to the internet, no more buying stuff from the Kindle store, because, you know, we breached the contract. There's no more contract. We don't have to continue to abide by any of the duties that we laid out, because the contract's gone. So you could try to sue for damages, but I don't think it would be to anyone's benefit to do that.
So under their limitation of liability section here of the terms of service, it does seem to sort of disclaim all breach of contract. Is that correct?
Yeah.
All liability for breach of contract?
I was trying to change my answer on that earlier. That's the way I initially read it. The limitation on liability reads, neither Amazon nor suppliers or licensors shall be liable to you for any incidental or consequential damages for breach of any implied or express warranty, breach of contract, it goes on. The way I first read that was Amazon nor its suppliers will be liable to you for incidental damages, breach of contract, or negligence or strict liability. A commenter pointed out that the way that should probably be read is they won't be liable for incidental or consequential damages for breach of warranty, breach of contract, negligence, strict liability. So it doesn't seem like they're disclaiming total liability for breach of contract. And indeed, later in the terms of service, they say, you know, any damages that come out of that will be limited to the purchase price of the Kindle. So it seems like they're allowing some measure for breach of contract, but it's very limited.
Can you totally do this in a limitation of liability provision within a contract? Can you basically disclaim liability for certain types of damages as broadly as this?
You can, but it may not hold up in court.
Ben, yeah. You want to elaborate on that theory?
States vary based on what you can and can't disclaim. In some states, you can't disclaim warranties. Like in Massachusetts, for instance, you can't... which warranty is it that you can't disclaim? I should know this. There are certain warranties that you can't disclaim. If you buy a toaster and the toaster says, we disclaim all warranties, and the toaster blows up, you can still sue them because their toaster blew up. I'm going to have to remember what the actual term is.
I think it might have been the warranty of merchantability.
Yes,
by the way.
The warranty of merchantability. You can't disclaim that. And states vary states vary as to what you can and cannot disclaim when it comes to these things.
To back up, contracts, are as they are enforced under the law, are specifically a state issue. So meaning if it goes into federal court, a federal court would still decide it under state law provisions, correct?
It is worth noting, though, that you're not going to get to federal court under the license agreement, the end-user license agreement here. Amazon makes you promise that if you're going to sue them, you're not actually going to sue them. You're going to go into confidential arbitration in Seattle, Washington. Unless, of course, you're threatening to violate Amazon's rights, in which case Amazon can sue you in federal court. Now, whether or not these arbitration agreements can be enforced varies from contract to contract, and it depends on the bargaining position of the two parties. It depends on what other factors there are. Whether or not it's a class action has sometimes influenced whether or not Amazon, not necessarily Amazon, the party who drafted the contract can actually enforce the arbitration provision. But essentially, it's a case by case analysis based on a lot of very factual, intense factors.
So one of our commentators also noted specific performance as a potential remedy, or at least he raised the question of whether or not it might be applicable in this circumstance. You want to talk a little bit about that?
This is by no means my area of expertise. His argument was that Amazon is granting you an irrevocable license to use that to that work. Amazon is essentially, it is granting you, but when they say you get a permanent right to this, they're saying, we are granting you a license to read this piece of work on your Kindle, and that license cannot be revoked by us, which is exactly what they did here. The commenter suggested that you could sue Amazon for what's called specific performance, basically suing Amazon and saying, you granted me an irrevocable license, then you revoked that license, and as a result, you should have to give me that thing that you previously granted me an irrevocable license for. Specific performance is not the most common of remedies. Now, I will say it is more likely in cases where you've got an irrevocable license. It is going to be a lot more likely when you've got a non-rivalrous good, like you do here. So a rivalrous good is something that you can, where you can exclude other people from using it. Like a laptop computer is a rivalrous good. If I'm in possession of my personal laptop computer, David, you cannot use my laptop computer. But when you've got a license to an electronic piece of work, you know, this kind of intellectual property in general is non-rivalrous. Yes, a physical book, you know, if I'm reading one specific copy of a book, you know, David couldn't be reading that copy, but David could be reading another copy. So there are a lot of factors to be weighed. I'm not an expert in the area of irrevocable licenses or specific performance, but it's not something that's very commonly granted.
Do you have any thoughts, Dominic?
No, I think Ben has done a wonderful job providing a comprehensive overview.
You are welcome.
Ben is clearly very well researched on this particular story. Yeah. So anyways, I mean, getting back to it, I guess we really don't think that it's very practical for someone to, or even for a class action or something against Amazon based on breach of contract. Although they could do it under the law, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of monetary value to be gained out of that. And of course, then you have the whole issue of what it costs to bring a lawsuit in the first place, especially if you try to certify it as a class and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. And this would be... I'm sorry if I could interrupt for a second.
Nope.
If they tried to bring this in federal court, it would be an extremely long and drawn-out battle because the first thing that Amazon would do would be to file a motion to compel arbitration, to basically saying, you know, when you bought the Kindle, you agreed that if you have any problems, you're going to go to arbitration, this confidential arbitration. And courts are very reluctant, specifically federal courts are very reluctant to say that a case won't go to arbitration, and they're very reluctant to overturn an arbitration decision once an arbitration decision has been made. So it would be very unlikely that it would be very hard to first get this in federal court and to keep it there, and it would be very hard to win this case and to make it worthwhile to win this case.
Still pretty interesting in the end of the day that Amazon decided to go ahead and breach their terms of service, though. Perhaps it's just further evidence that the people that draft these types of terms of service agreements, not just Amazon, but a lot of different companies, still hold a lot of bargaining power in the end of the day when it comes to the types of stuff that they're, in fact, licensing. And, you know, sometimes they can make a decision that, hey, maybe a breach isn't so bad and we're not going to be held out on the hook, especially if it's something minimal like a single book or whatever. So before we wrap this up, do you guys have any final thoughts on that?
No, I'm all set. I've talked this thing to death at this point.
I think we're all set.
Good. So before we sign off for this week, we have one other quick thing to mention. And we received news this week that Apple has, in fact, shut down the Palm Pre iTunes syncing. And we had covered this in a previous podcast. Dominic, you were the one that brought this to my attention. Any quick thoughts?
We saw it coming.
We saw it coming, yeah. I think that's pretty true. So I think that's just about it for this week. And be sure to tune in next week. And like I said, the podcast might sort of come in a little bit of staggered order over the next 2 weeks, but we expect by August that things should be running smoothly again. So stay tuned, and thanks for listening. Once again, my name is David O'Brien, and with me is...
Dominic Rabier.
And Ben Snitkoff.
Thanks for listening.